This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. When I visited the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston last week, I saw a room full of paintings of heads, men's heads of all shapes and sizes, floating, disembodied on vibrant planes of color. Most of them were sticking their tongues out. The artist is Steve Locke, and his solo show at the ICA is called There Is No One Left to Blame. Locke is an artist who's lived and worked in Boston for 3 decades, but he grew up in Detroit. And as a kid, he says his second home was the world-renowned Detroit Institute of Art. He'd often skip school to visit the museum, and one day he saw a painting that inspired him to become a painter.
I came around the corner one day and I saw a Van Gogh self-portrait in a yellow hat, and I felt like he reached across time to talk to me. That was probably the germinal moment for me where I thought, I need to look at a lot of these things. I need to look at these things all the time.
And if Van Gogh could reach through time, he might find a kindred spirit in Steve Locke's haunting, mysterious paintings. When I visited the exhibit, I was joined by Steve, as well as by the ICA's chief curator, Helen Molesworth. She says she first saw Steve's paintings at a gallery in Boston and was drawn to them because of how perplexing they were and because of the questions they raised. Questions like this.
Are the figures sticking out their tongues in disgust? Are they sticking out their tongues as teasing? Are they sticking out their tongues in death? Is it about language or the absence of language? Is it about sexuality and pleasure? You know, this whole field of meaning and possible interpretation. And I found that I never rested on just one, and I never felt like, I've got it, Steve Locke's work is about X.
When you talk to Steve Locke about his paintings and what they mean, you end up talking about a lot of things beyond the canvas, about race, AIDS, loss, politics, even his native Detroit, as you'll hear in a moment. But it starts with his powerful paintings. So here's what they look like. They're visually lush, full of colors, both bright and somber ones. And as ICA curator Helen Molesworth says, they're ambiguous in many ways. Molesworth is really good at putting visual art into words, so listen to her description of one of Locke's paintings.
In this instance, we're looking at a fairly large painting. It's about probably 4 feet by 5 feet. And there is the head of a man who is hovering in the upper half of the painting without any torso, with no neck, so just the outline of the bottom chin. And the man is very ambiguously raced, as I could say. I mean, he floats on a field of very pink, almost erotic, sort of nipple-colored flesh. And yet he has what some people might feel are typical, quote-unquote, African-American features. So already you have a really profound question of, like, who is this person? What is the race of this person? And he is sticking out his tongue, and it is a big, gorgeous, red, pink, healthy tongue. Any acupuncturist would love this tongue. And it sets off the pink. It makes the pink more de Kooning-esque, who was a great painter of flesh tones. And so the painting is simultaneously profoundly sensual and, dare I say, even somewhat erotic because of the quality of the pink, but super disturbing because there is a very disembodied, floating male head that could be dead or could be alive. That's another fundamental ambiguity in the painting.
Wow. Yeah. I'm so glad I asked you to describe this, because I'm looking at this painting now with levels of complexity that I hadn't at first observed. Steve, tell me about this theme.
This is the thing about portraiture, and specifically the portraiture of men. Historically, it's an indication of state power. So it's very hard to go through art history and find pictures of men that don't look powerful, that don't look self-assured, that don't look in control. So I started to think about how to make images of men that looked vulnerable, looked available, or looked troubled in some way without resorting to obvious tropes like painting someone nude or painting someone nailed to a cross. And, you know, the tongue is like, you know, It's about language. It's about communication. We talk about speaking in tongues. So it's a pretty loaded metaphor.
Sometimes it's a sign of disrespect, right?
Well, you know, when a little kid does it, it's funny. When the waiter does it, it's like a little disgusting. So it's a little bit, kids come in and look at the paintings and they stick their tongues out at the paintings and it's okay. So it becomes a thing where you think, well, when is that gesture not okay anymore?
When I look at these pictures, there's sort of vulnerability is a really good word that comes to mind, but also sort of sense of loss, discomfort as well.
It's a challenging time in this country right now. We're having this discussion about who gets to be included in that we the people. And, you know, I'm of a certain age. I'm 50. My experience as a gay man living through the AIDS epidemic and the tremendous swath of people that were eliminated by that, partially eliminated by disease, but also partially eliminated by inaction and apathy. So that's a lot of what comes into the work. I've said to people before that I'm not an entertainer. My work isn't designed to make people feel good. I think it's lovely to look at. I really do. I've tried to use all the nicest colors. But at the same token, it's my job to make you look at something. And that's the challenge I take on. And painting these things that are really about the culture where we are right now as a people.
I want to circle back. You mentioned that you grew up in Detroit. Yeah. Detroit happens to be a city that I'm sort of in love with and sort of enthralled by, and I stumbled by accident into the Detroit Institute of Art a few years ago, and it blew my mind.
It's incredible.
It's an amazing museum. And what are you thinking about these days when you read the stories about poor Detroit and the possibility of, you know, selling off pieces of that artistic legacy and so on and so forth?
Well, first of all, I will say this about the museum, that people will line up in the streets to protect that museum from being looted. There was a tax increase where people willingly agreed to increase their own taxes to fund and protect the museum. So that is the soul of that city. It really is. I think the hardest thing for me is the way that people talk about Detroit like it's vacant or it's absent. There's an amazing, thriving music scene that has always been there. There are real visual artists and real contemporary artists who are working right now in Detroit. But art isn't enough to save that city. That's not what it's about. There has to be a real investment in the people who live there, who actually have resources to bear. Detroit is an 85% African-American city. New York was in a similar situation and was bailed out by the federal government. So there's things at work in terms of what is happening in Detroit which have to do with blaming people for things that are not their fault. So somehow the looting of the city by corporate interests and by banks is a way for people to make an argument about its population not being responsible. And that's the thing that's problematic.
So, Helen, we just sort of launched into a conversation about Detroit. And I'm thinking, is that relevant to what's going on in this room?
It is, I think, relevant to what's going on. I think if you ask yourself the kinds of questions Steve is asking us to ask ourselves, like, who constitutes a public figure? You know, who's vulnerable? Who's not vulnerable? Who's in charge? Who's not in charge? What is our relationship to minority versus majority images? I think you will find yourself thinking about issues like the ones you find in Detroit, where what does it mean that the city that's failing is a black city? You will find yourself, I think, very quickly in this show thinking about Trayvon Martin and thinking about what it means that we live in a culture that on the one hand can elect a black president and on the other hand can have many of its citizens still feel that a black teenager in a hoodie is a criminal. And I think the paintings get you into this thing of asking yourself uncomfortable questions.
Well, Steve Locke, thank you very, very much for talking to us.
I love your show.
Thanks. And Helen Molesworth, thank you as well.
Thanks always, Anthony, for coming by.
That was Helen Molesworth, chief curator at the ICA in Boston, with Steve Locke, a Boston-based painter. His show is called There Is No One Left to Blame. It's at the ICA through October 27th. You can find images from the show at radioboston.org. And this program note, this Wednesday we'll be talking with former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. We're going to hear from him about the great poems that shaped him as a writer. We want to hear about your favorite poems. Give us a call on Wednesday to talk to Robert Pinsky or post them on Facebook or Twitter at Radio Boston. And that's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.